Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man. Yo, guys, welcome back to the Leverage Podcast. We've got a great guest and a very good friend of mine, Ford. Welcome, Ford.
Hey, Robbie.
Good to have you on here, man. I've been wanting to interview you for a long time. Ford's an amazing entrepreneur, very big in the real estate game. We met in Ukraine a few years ago where you were thinking of investing in some real estate there. Actually, you own some real estate there, which we'll get into. You're thinking of opening a yoga studio, I meant to say, which I think is still in the works, but obviously the war is interrupting that situation. You're also a member of the Leverage Group, which is awesome. And you're always sharing your wisdom in there about real estate and personal finance and career and, you know, all the things that you've been so successful with. And as a wedding gift, which was the best wedding gift we got, Ford let me and Maria stay in your penthouse overlooking the Bellagio fountain in the Vidara in Las Vegas, where we celebrated our wedding. So that was an unbelievable experience. And I think you own 10 units in there, which is
right. Pretty
incredible. But, you know, start us back from the beginning, how you got into, you know, real estate and more specifically, I guess, student housing, or even before you get into that, you know, how did you, you know, even acquire the funds to get into real estate? And how did you just start your career off?
Well, I'll always preface my life story with saying that I'm probably the luckiest guy that you'll meet. So I was able to maybe see some opportunities where maybe, you know, nobody else did, or was in the right place at the right time, you know, just by chance. And my diversion into real estate, I started out, Robbie, as a veterinarian. And when I was 7 years old, I decided I wanted to be an animal doctor, and didn't change my mind, and I was a oldest child, classic overachiever. And I ended up getting into vet school early and getting out of vet school by the time I was 23, and started a career of what my childhood dream was, which was being a vet. And I had the chance to do some amazing work as a vet. But after 12 or 15 years, I had ended up in Boulder, Colorado, and I was pretty burned out and looking for a different profession.
You're working at SeaWorld for a bit, weren't you?
Right. I had put in the time and worked at SeaWorld as a dolphin vet. And it was an interesting experience. You know, of course, the dolphins are amazing, but you're working for a corporation. Mm. So I'd have to say that it was a bit of a dream killer, to be honest, once I got there. And then I went ahead and after SeaWorld, I ended up in Colorado. And I'm just back working, doing just mainly small animal medicine. And I'm at lunch one day, eating at Wendy's of all places. And it's like October, and ski season is about to come up. And this is back, let's say that this is about 1996. So, you know, people still read newspapers then, and classified ads were still relevant. So, you know, the internet was a thing, but it wasn't a marketplace just yet. So I'm reading the local newspaper because I'm interested in getting a pair of skis for ski season. And I'm living in Boulder, Colorado, and I'm looking at it's a college town, rich college town. And I had come back from my SeaWorld experience and working overseas with no money. I had zero money in my pocket at the age of 30. And I had a lot of great travel experiences, lived in Australia from like 26 to 29, lived in New Zealand for a year. And then I came back to the States, but I was broke. And, you know,
spent all your money on the travels.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and when you're working for SeaWorld, you don't make very much money.
Right.
So it's a kind of a job that everyone wants to do for free. So they don't have to pay their vets very well. So I had a lot of great life experience and I had no money. And then I got to Colorado, was working for a couple of years, had a little bit saved up, but I'm eating at Wendy's for lunch, you know, getting a spicy chicken combo menu and trying to buy a used pair of skis off of some rich college student out of the student newspaper. And the classified ads, the way that they worked back then is there's one column that's for sporting goods and the column next to it is real estate. So I'm looking for a pair of skis and then my eyes kind of go to the next column over and sees a for sale by owner. And it was a student rental triplex. And this lady had a triplex for sale that she had kind of bought and her two sons had gone to university there and now they had graduated and she was ready to sell it. And I went and looked at this house and it had kind of a three-bedroom apartment on each floor. And there was a top floor, a main floor, a second floor, and a basement. And so there's 9 bedrooms total. And I can't tell you how bad it looked. It was horrendous. It was something out of Animal House, you know? But when I went home and I did the math, I saw that, like, if I bought this place for, at the time it was $400,000, which was crazy price, but if I bought it, that the two other units, the rent from the two units would cover the mortgage and I would have a free place to live. And so this was all I needed to pull the trigger. And I have to tell you that at that time, there was really significant yearly market increases. Like the real estate market was hot, hot, hot. And so maybe this house 5 years ago was like 200,000. So as I entered this environment, and I'm from Texas where all of the houses were like half the price of these Colorado houses. So as I entered that environment, the consensus of everybody was that this was the top of the real estate market. Real estate cannot possibly go any higher. You should just wait a couple of years and, you know, wait till the market cools down. And I'm so happy I didn't listen to that advice. Right. The real estate market has not cooled down in the 30 years since I bought that place. So I ended up buying my first property in 1996 and it was, a $400,000 dump, but it had the bones and it had the permits and it had the rental license it had everything. So I lived in a unit for a year, fixed it up while I lived.
How did you afford the down payment? Because obviously the mortgage was covered by the rental.
Glad you mentioned that because I almost skipped over that. So back then there was a moment in time when the lending standards were much easier than they are now. So I had about $40,000 to put down, which was just about 10% down payment.
Okay.
And there were loan programs available for me to buy the property with 10% down.
Gotcha.
Those of course they're not here now. And it was actually kind of a loan program where you got a normal 80% loan and then they would do a second loan for the remaining 10%, you know.
Was it like a first time buyer or something?
It wasn't a first time buyer. It's just kind of they would give you an immediate home equity loan for 10% at the time of close. Being lucky.
At that point, like what percentage of that was your net worth? Like how big of a gamble was that? 40K, because you know people were in your ear saying real estate's gonna
right.
You know,
It was everything I had. And I have to tell you that I'd had some previous stock market experience when I was like kind of in my early mid-20s. And I lost like quite a bit in the stock market, the first tech bubble that they had. And so I ended up saving this money and putting it in a savings account instead of in the stock market. And one thing I'd like to kind of point out to people when they're kind of getting their, because if you're going to invest in real estate, you need to have money for your down payment. And let's just say realistically right now, with today's prices, that's going to be about $100,000 to put down on a, you know, kind of a small to medium sized property. And the one thing that I did right the second time around is I didn't put my initial down payment in a high risk investment. I kind of like resisted the, you know, the urge to turbocharge, you know, try to get to that 100,000. I resisted that urge to put this in high risk investments, and I just put it in savings accounts. And it was a little more boring and it took me a little longer, but I got my down payment money the second time around.
Wait, on the next, I'm a little confused. On the next purchase or?
I lost all of my down payment money that I would have had on the stock market, on the tech market bubble in my mid 20s. So I had to start out at zero at 30.
And you saved that to basically that 40K.
From 30 to 32, I made a financial plan where I took half my income and I put it in savings, and the other half I paid bills and had fun money with. So I was on a program for 2 years where I saved 50% of my payroll.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's a very strict plan.
Well, yeah, you gotta, I think if you're a single guy though, you can do it, right? It's not that hard to, you know, single guys can kind of live pretty cheap. They can kind of live that college life a little bit longer and put that money away. And it's important, the way money compounds, it's important to kind of get your first real estate down payment early. So
you had that. How did you kind of learn about real estate in the first place? For me, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and my dad gave me the book. So that is what got me thinking about it when I was about, you know, 19 or 20 years old. You know, but what kind of gave you that idea? Was it after the stock market, you know, collapsed and you're like, I'm going to try something else? Like, how'd you educate yourself is my long-winded question there.
Well, what's interesting is that I accidentally did everything that these real estate books recommended. And somehow I had the sense to do and make the choices that, you know, because I kind of did this right at the same time that Rich Dad, Poor Dad was coming out, and I didn't know about that book. Mm-hmm. And then there's a book in that same group written by one of his, one of the guys on his staff, that's Rolf de Roos, and it's called Real Estate Riches. And that's a real timeless book that I would recommend if you want to buy a used copy off of eBay. Or Amazon, but I didn't have that much real estate education. I basically was looking for a pair of skis and ended up with a house, you know. So, and then everything I learned, I kind of learned as I went.
So that was a pretty big risk. You know, you took all your savings. You know, I guess you had a decent amount of disposable income if you were able to save 50% of, you know, what you're making, but you said you lived frugally. And yeah, I mean, sometimes I talk to guys, you know, that are in the group or, you know, reaching out and they're like, yeah, I basically save nothing. I spend it's, you know, not having that at least sort of like background in financial education is super important. And, you know, it at least sounds like you did a pretty good job of educating yourself on the different options out there.
Well, one thing that I learned, so, you know, the reason that I chose real estate, and I can't say that I knew this when I bought that house, because when I lost all that money in the first tech bubble crash, what I understood is that the stock market is an information game. And the winners in the stock market are the ones that get the information first. And the little guys like me are the last to get that information. And we can't act fast enough to make money. And then the stock prices change. And so basically, and the way these stock market fluctuations work is they just kind of shake all the coins out of the little guy's pocket. And, you know, it's you're the last person in the stock market game. You're the last person to get paid, because when you, let's just say like you buy like a index fund, right? So there's the guy that sold you the index fund that gets a little front load fee. There's the market maker that makes the money, that makes their money between the buy and the sell price. There's the fund manager that makes their money no matter what the fund does. And then there's all the CEOs and all the staff that's got those crazy, you know, if you've been to a CEO's house, that's your money that built their house, right? So, and all of those guys make money before you make money off of their stock investments. So, or off of your investment in their stock fund. And when I understood that, I'm a little bit of a control freak. And the thing that was so appealing about real estate is that I could drive by and look at it every day, and right. I could make all the decisions about that house, right?
Live
I could
there.
It was mine. There was no real outside influence. It didn't matter if, the price of oil fluctuated and somehow that affected my stock or whatever, you know. So none of that mattered. And I will say, Robbie, like when I bought my first house, that getting off of that little gerbil wheel of watching stock market prices go up and down every day and having that affect your mood, you know, maybe some of the listeners can relate to, you know, watching crypto prices every day.
And I was just about to say what you're describing is exactly the same as the crypto markets, especially now.
Yeah.
As big institutions are at play now. And yeah, if you don't have the information, good luck. And I've done very well in crypto, but I did very well, you know, just by being in very early, kind of luckily, and riding the waves. But I feel like now I really have not a lot of business being in crypto, because I'm just not willing to put in the time to do the research and to get the information first. And it's the same game. So,
And it was such a relief after I bought my first property, after my first couple of properties, I never had to look at the stock market again, you know, for 30 years, I didn't care what the stock market did. And I was just free of that trap. And free of being at the whim of market makers and money managers and stuff like that. So, there's some other things that I understood, you know, going into that first house. You know, the thing about real estate, especially residential real estate, is that as long as there's population growth, you know, there's going to be people that need a place to live. And, you know, we're not stopping our population from booming. So, that is a, you know, a driver of the real estate market. And people will always need a place to live, no matter if it's a recession or, you know, what the economy is doing. People always need a house over their heads. So there's some basic fundamental understanding, like at that level, that I kind of got, you know.
So you get this first place, you've got your tenants in there who are students, you're living there also. What was it kind of like just starting off? Did you have to do any sort of remodels? Because you said the place was kind of a dump, not that students care.
Well,
and these are Boulder students, right?
Right. And, you know, it's very interesting to me when I look at today's investor, because it seems that everybody wants to like invest their money and just not care, like just invest it, and then not do a thing and then let it like grow or double or triple. And what I can say about this like current attitude towards investing without any effort or work on your part is that it to me, it introduces an unacceptable amount of risk. So sure, you can buy crypto and it's like you don't have to do anything with it. You just kind of wait and sell it when it's higher. But the risk is much higher. Whereas if you buy real estate, okay, you've got to work that house. You've got to put in some sweat equity. But the security that you get with putting in 5 to 10 hours a week of work on a rental property is absolutely worth it to me. I remember I was speaking at a different financial seminar a few years ago, and you know, and it basically came down to a lot of limiting beliefs that people have around real estate are like, you know, I don't want to like plunge toilets and like, you know, take care of like complaining tenants. And I'm like, for $1 million, I'll plunge a toilet, you know? Sure. So, you know, kind of the end of that story, when I sold that house, like 10 years later, that $400,000 house, I sold it for $2.1 million. And like, was that worth? So I'll tell you, you know, living with college students above and below me, you know, they come home at 2:30 in the morning and, you know, they're just on completely different sleep schedules and they brought the whole bar to their house. I've got like crazy stories I could tell you. And of course, I've got lots of like crazy landlord stories. But, you know,
as a young single guy, that doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah. Was it worth $1.6 million? Yes, absolutely it was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
and had you been not living there, you would have been cash flowing, you know, every month and had that extra income. And, well, you're saving, you are cash flowing because you're not paying rent.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I was in a super cheap mode at that time. And I was doing all of the renovation work myself because I had done construction in college to work my way through college. So I was really, you know, doing the sweat equity on those first houses and doing all of the remodeling myself and everything and kind of working as a vet half time and then, you know, a home renovator the other half of the time. You don't have to do that. It just kind of was the way that I started and it kind of was a rocket ride. It really propelled me. So what happened, you know, I took 3 years to renovate. I took a year in each one of those three units. And at the end of the third year, when I'd kind of done, finished renovating the house was now worth $750,000. And I was able to refi and get $200,000, do a cash out refi and get $200,000 out and buy two more rental properties just by doing a cash out refi. Once I put that first $40,000 in on the first property, I never really took any more money out of my pocket on a down payment for another property.
That's crazy. Yeah, and future, as soon as you tell everyone what else you have now, it's going to be even crazier. But one more question before we move on to the other ones. Were you able to do those remodels with the tenants in there? Or would you do it like when they were gone for the summer?
No. Well, I was always working in my own unit.
Okay.
And yeah, there was times when, you know, because I mean, I started my renovation work at 7 or 8 in the morning. And, you know, there's times when they hated it and like, you know, they yelled at me. And then, of course, I would yell at them when they came home drunk at 2 in the morning. So we, you know, it's just some classic landlord stories about it. But, you know, I got through it, renovated the places. I never tried to renovate a unit that that a student tenant was living in.
Oh, so you'd switch units you lived in and renovate that one.
Yeah, it was always okay. The one that I was living in. So I would move into a different one each year and then take a year to fix that one up.
Okay, that answers that. Because I was like, wow, you renovated with the students and that'd be tough, but now it makes sense. So that's amazing. So you got the 200,000 equity out and then you got two more places and both you put 100K down on both of them roughly?
And there was something that accidentally I learned on that first house. And that was the genius of student rentals. So you'll find that there's a lot of real estate professionals, and every kind of real estate professional has their niche, right? There's something that they kind of like that they do, you know. And I've got a friend that his kind of specialty is he does the pad sites for Cane's Chicken, you know, and he just kind of owns the ground that all these Cane's Chicken units are on, right? And I mean, so everybody's got a niche, but the student rentals are advantageous in so many ways. So I should probably tell you that now about why student rentals are so great. By the way, I have a website called studentrentals.com, and it kind of goes over the decision-making process and how student rentals are probably better than any other real estate investment that I've found.
That's a great site just for you guys listening, because you've shared that before with us in the leverage okay. group, and guys, we've gotten a lot of value out of that. So, you know, there's a bunch of amazing free information there. So please,
studentrentals.com, yeah, plural.
I'll drop a link too.
The thing about students versus normal people is that, you know, people kind of have this animal house view of students. And the truth is, I don't know, students may be messy, they may be dirty, but they don't damage, you know, they don't punch holes in the wall you know, you're generally renting to upper middle class people, right? So even though they're young and they're not house trained, what normally happens is that they just move into a unit, they don't clean it for a year, and then you get it back, and then you got to do like a big cleaning at the end of the year. And yeah, there's a lot of parties have gone on and all that, but you know, these houses that I bought in Boulder in that neighborhood were all 80 years old, and they'd been having students in them for the last 50 years. So you know, they were fine. They had good bones, solid houses, and you just kind of had to clean them up once a year when the kids moved out.
And students pay the rent.
So yeah, so this compared to normal people. Mm-hmm. Who, the thing about normal people is that they're always in transition. Okay. They're either getting married or they're getting divorced. They're getting a job transfer. They're having a kid. They just got fired from the job and they can't pay rent anymore. So I rented sometimes to normal people that, you know, interviewed really great as far as like, you know, a tenant showing, and then always 3 months later, they're telling me they need to break the lease, right? With students, they're locked in for a year. And not only are they locked in for a year, but like they do not want to go home. So they all are there during the summer break. And then what you said, Robbie, they're backed by these $100,000 college funds. You know, every parent has saved their whole life to be able to pay rent for this kid to go to school. And what I learned is that there was a real market for high-end student rentals, because most all the student rentals in that area were trashed. And if you had nice kitchens, nice baths, there's a lot of rich kids. And I specifically rented to rich college girls. And, you know, the daddy wanted them to live in a nice place, and it didn't matter what it cost. They had the $100,000 college fund. They didn't right. care if their daughter paid $800 a month or $1,200 a month. They wanted them to be able to walk to campus and have a cute place to live and have their own bathroom. And it didn't matter.
Right.
So, and then, you know, I went through a couple of recessions. I think about 2008, there was a pretty big recession. And when a recession hits, people may lose their job, but the students keep going to school because they're yeah. still backed by that college fund. And all the people that lost their job, they go back to school. So in a recession, there's actually increased pressure because they go and get advanced degrees, right? Right. So you'll see a spike in enrollment at universities when there's a recession. So in a bad economy, the rents, my rental increases on my student rentals actually were higher in recessions than they were in good economies.
Wow. There's
bigger
That's
spikes in
fascinating.
enrollment. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. That's very cool.
So it's almost a recession proof model. And yeah, and then the kids are there for a year, and then they change, and then you get a new batch in, and it's a very stable, you know, model.
Mm-hmm. So were those the next two properties you purchased as well? More student housing?
I always bought student rentals after that. And I bought and I should probably tell you a little bit more about, about my luck. In 1998, there was a riot in Boulder after a football weekend. And there was a street in particular where they had like 1,000, 2,000 kids had gathered, and the police were trying to break them up. And they turned over all the cars, and they had a bunch of sofas on the porches, and they set the sofas on fire in the street, made a bonfire. And the day after these riots, there's a for sale sign going up. And I went on a shopping spree and bought two more houses. My next two houses, I bought the 2 or 3 days after this riot, when everyone was like just in shock. You know, there was like burn marks on the yards and everything. And I saw that as a buying opportunity. And so I bought two more houses at a 30% discount because I bought them in a riot zone. The landlord was completely freaked out about the riot, and he was like giving away the houses. And
amazing.
So I bought those houses at 30% discount. And then I waited 2 months, got them reappraised, and did a cash out refi for another $200,000 and bought two more houses right next to it.
Wow.
Eventually, I
Monopoly,
ended up,
you bought up the whole block.
I did. I ended up buying six out of the nine houses on that block, and it was like kind of the best block of off-campus living. Slowly I put together six student rentals and then an apartment building. And after 15 years, I went from the six tenants that I had initially to like 115.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And what about, you know, you had, I'm guessing, a ton of cash flow coming in from all this rent. What'd you do with did you stop, you know, your vet job? How busy were you like managing the places? What was your, like, you know, your time allocation like?
So it was about 5 years after I bought my first house that I was able to stop being a vet and be a landlord full time. And Robbie, you bring up kind of an interesting point, because what I think people miss about where you make money in real estate, it's not really on the income. And you'll hear people talk about cap rates, and they're like, and then some people get really crazy about cap rates. And what a cap rate is the net income on a property compared to your payment, your purchase price. But the real beauty and the real secret of real estate is, and what I want to maybe explain a little bit more, is that for 20 plus years, I was making 45% a year return on my money in a secure way. And again, what's fascinating about this is, like, if you were to have a stock picker make a 45% return on their money, he would make the cover of Forbes magazine, right?
Of course.
And I did it. And I'm going to just tell you very simply how I did it. And it's something that everyone can duplicate. So the first thing you've got to do is just be sure that you pick a student rental in a good location, you know, in a good market. But let's take that house that I first bought. So let's just say that at the time that I bought it, it was worth $500,000. Okay. And let's just say that for by today's standards, let's just say that you put $100,000 to buy a $500,000 house. Okay. In a hot market like in Boulder, Colorado, the average yearly real estate appreciation is 11%. So let's just round that down to 10%. So in 1 year, that house is worth $550,000. Okay. So what I did is I took out a $400,000 loan. I put a $100,000 down payment on it. And after 1 year, the house is now worth $50,000 more than I bought it for. So the $50,000 in appreciation after 1 year compared to the $100,000 down payment that I made was a 50% return on my down payment. Mm-hmm. So you asked about cash flow, but what really happened for me is I was just the money shuffler. I was taking that rents and paying off the loans and moving that money around. But where I was really getting my net worth was making that 50%. You know, it ends up being a little bit less than 50% when you do the exact math. But that is how you get rich in real estate, is on the appreciation, not on the income.
And over a long period of time, regardless of, you know, market trends, it's still going up as populations are continuing to grow.
Right. And even, I mean, and it's extraordinary, even if your average yearly appreciation is only 4 or 5%, that translates into like a 30% return on your investment, on your down payment. Mm. And there's another concept that is kind of unique to real estate that's really important. And that is that I think we've all heard that it takes money to make money. Well, there's no easier place to borrow money than in real estate. And there's no easier place for someone to give you money than to buy a property. So this is called leverage. When I can, like, let's take that initial example of a $500,000 property, and I can get $400,000 from the bank as a loan, and then, you know, leverage that against my $100,000 down payment. The appreciation is on the whole $500,000, but I only have to put in 20%, and I only have to put it. That's that leverage is what makes the 50% return on my money, because I get to use someone else's money. And this is a really unique concept that is very hard to get outside of real estate. So this is another 5-star reason why real estate investments are better than, you know, stocks and, you know, most any other types of investments.
Yeah. I mean, I was, as most people know who listen to the podcast, you know, I've talked about how I made a lot of money in Airbnb over the years. And most of that when I got started was simply, you know, Airbnb arbitrage, as I call it, which is not buying a place, you know, renting it and then subletting it through Airbnb. But on the properties that I did purchase, those were much bigger windfalls, as you already explained. So, you know, one was great for cash flow, but your model really builds long-term wealth. And also you can have some cash flow, like you said, but it doesn't really matter in comparison to the long-term game.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been in some situations where you have really great cash flows, but they still don't compare to the appreciation. And it's hard because it's a long game, right? I just, over the last 5 years, did I start selling these properties and cashing out and realizing, you know, it's all on paper, right? Until you sell. And so it took me, you know, 25 years to kind of realize those paper gains, but they're there, and, you know, they're real, and you can do it at any time.
Oh, and the other thing I wanted to bring up, I know there's the, some people might be listening like, well, what about the tax implications? But in real estate, you can reinvest what you make, and it basically you can exchange one property for another and you avoid taxes. Is that correct? It's called like a 1031 exchange.
Yeah, that's called a 1031 exchange. So I guess the best way to explain this is that those tax laws are made by, you know, congressmen. Those congressmen are influenced by rich people, and rich people own real estate. So tax laws are naturally favorable to real estate investors. And for probably the first 20 years that I was in real estate, I paid zero taxes. So, you know, there's so many tax deductions available with a real estate investment. There's so many ways that you can expense your income and offset your income with different expenses, and there's depreciation. There's just things in a real estate investment that are not available for any other investments. So, you know, if the rich people are real estate investors and they're making the tax breaks for themselves, that's just another reason why you should invest in real estate too.
Yeah. Makes sense.
There's one ridiculous tax shelter that I'd like to maybe mention to your guys, if they live in the US, and that is owning real estate in a Roth IRA. And it's a little bit of an advanced concept, but if you can get enough money in your Roth IRA, which you can get by rolling over a 401k, for example, you can roll over 401k into a Roth IRA. And a Roth IRA, you pay the taxes up front as you put it into the Roth IRA account, and then you never pay taxes on it again.
You can cash out when you're 55, right?
Yes, but but when you're cashing out, it doesn't matter what the value is. What you can do is you can buy a property in a Roth IRA, and all of the income is tax-free from there on out, and all of the appreciation is tax-free from there on out. So it's a little bit of a complicated strategy to mention here, but if I just mention these keywords and people can follow up, there's a very good firm in Denver, Colorado called New Direction Trust Company. And you can find their website and get a lot more information about owning real estate in a Roth IRA. But it's the biggest shelter that I know.
Yeah, it's an amazing strategy. What I did when I used to have the corporate office job that I hated, I was getting matched into my 401k. Mm-hmm. And I heard about this strategy back in the day. So I converted my 401k into a Roth. Mm-hmm. And so my employer was matching the contributions in there. And then I could contribute up to, it was like $4,500 a year or something. And yeah, I still have, I stopped this corporate job. So I stopped getting those contributions, but I was still putting money into the Roth, and that's been growing ever since. And that's been my plan. Exactly what you said is when I have invested in real estate, but it's always been with other partners and not directly. And I own some property in Ukraine, which I couldn't put in my Roth. Maybe I could have, but that is what I'm planning on doing when I do purchase some real estate here soon in the US. Because basically, yeah, it's, if anyone's confused by that, it's pretty simple. Like instead of you buying the property, it's owned by the Roth. You know, it's just like a corporation kind of. It'd be like the corporation buys the property instead of you buying the property. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Trust. The trust company.
Right.
The Roth IRA buys it.
And you own the Roth.
And it's a tax-free entity. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So tell us what happened next when, you know, so you're just kind of chugging along, growing your portfolio.
Well, to get back to the exact moment when I quit, I was cash flowing about $1,000 extra a month. And that was enough for me to quit as a veterinarian. So, but I had, you know, probably I don't know, maybe 2 million in real estate that, you know, I had like maybe 1.5 million in loans on 2 million in real estate. And I'm just like shuffling money around and I'm like clearing like $1,000 a month. And then I ended up playing poker professionally for pocket money for about 5 years. And then the property started cash flowing again enough that I didn't need to do that anymore. But so kind of the point I'd like to make is that it's okay. And even back when I was buying these properties, bank loans were like at 7%, 8%. So sometimes my properties weren't even cash flowing. They were like slightly negative cash flow year on year. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that that's okay compared to the value of the appreciation that you're getting, the 50% return on your down payment. And it's okay to like break even or make just a very little bit the first 5 years. That's kind of normal as far as your cash flow. So don't be shy about your first property, maybe not cash flowing that well, because it's almost to be expected. And also there's some things to look for. Like, is the reason that your property is not cash flowing is because it's like a, you know, it's in really bad shape and you're going to do a renovation and you know that you can, in a year, you can increase your rents 20%. If that's the case, then for sure, pull the trigger and go ahead and buy that property because you know that you're going to cash flow once the renovation is done. So, and are you in a market where the rents go up each year? You know, there's things that you can kind of do a little bit of data analysis and look at what the average median rent has done the last 5 years, the last 10 years. And of course you want to kind of be in a market where there's steady rent increases. And then you can kind of count on that for your future income growth. And then 5 years, you're starting to cash flow. And then at 10 years into a property, you're really making some serious income. And you're kind of on easy street about 10 years into it. But don't be afraid those first few years of just being the money shuffler. And you're just taking the risk and paying the bank.
Can you explain why that changes? What happens after that 5 to 10 years? So you've paid down the loan and so you're cash flowing more because of that?
Well, first of all, the loan stays the same. It's not exactly paid down, but in inflation terms, the loan gets cheaper because the dollar amount stays the same while inflation goes up. And your rents, inflation is factored into your rents. Mm-hmm. So your rents are going up, your loans stay the same. And also your expenses tend to go down after 5 years because you've got a lot of expenses as you're fixing up a property in those first couple of years and investing in it to make it nicer. Your expenses are kind of high, but after a while, you don't really have any more expenses because you fixed everything up.
And what if you don't have much of a
background? Expenses go down and rents go up.
And if you don't have much of a background in rehabs or doing those fixer uppers, would you still recommend that? Like just to hire someone to do that sort of stuff for you?
Or
learn the skill?
So maybe that increases your expenses because now you've got to hire some workers and everything. But if you're a real estate investor, first of all, you've got to learn about, you know, what it takes to remodel a kitchen. So first of all, you got to, you know, don't be afraid to do the process and educate yourself. And then maybe you don't need to do the work directly, but you just kind of need to know enough to be able to hire someone and know when they do good work or not. But don't be afraid or don't pass up investing in real estate just because you maybe can't do the work yourself. It's okay to not do the work yourself, but it just may take a little bit longer for the property to cash flow the way you want it to.
Well, I had that exact experience with, with some of my Airbnb places when I first got started. We realized we could add additional bedrooms to a property, sometimes with the landlord's permission, sometimes without. In New York, it's pretty easy because you can get those walls, non-permanent walls that just kind of go in and they don't require really any sort of extra work. But when you add an additional bedroom, you can hike up the rent. And then
Huge
we
shock.
started, yeah. So we start then we started doing like actual, wall installations and that sort of thing. And I had no experience in that whatsoever. But like you said, I learned it pretty fast. And that strategy of just adding bedrooms, that was a huge increase. Because the rents go up, as you said.
And I'm glad you pointed that out, Robbie, because when you're looking at a property, the most important thing to look at is the number of bedrooms, because the bedrooms dictate the rent. It doesn't matter how many bathrooms are in there, doesn't matter what the kitchen looks like, doesn't matter how big the living room is, it doesn't matter if it has a living room and a den, unless you plan on putting the den into an extra bedroom. But the most important thing to base a property on is the number of bedrooms. And so that is why my sweet spot was triplexes and fourplexes, because just take your regular house lot, okay? If you go and buy a single family home on that lot, the lot costs the same whether there's three bedrooms on there or it's a triplex with nine bedrooms. So you should pick a property that's got a high number of bedrooms for the amount of ground that it's on, because the ratio of bedrooms to the dirt is, that much better for you. So that makes it that much better an investment. So if you're going to buy nine bedrooms, because that's what dictates your income, is the bedrooms, and in my case, the students living in the bedrooms, it's better to do that on one property with a triplex versus three properties that's got three different roofs and it's like three little single family homes that are each three bedroom. So it's much better to look at triplexes or fourplexes. If you get over four units, then you kind of end up in the commercial real estate world and the loans aren't as favorable and it's just a little bit different animal. If you're starting out, start with a duplex or a triplex or fourplex. Probably most first-time investors would be a duplex or triplex would be the sweet spot, but definitely avoid the single-family homes.
Yeah, my buddies and I bought a fourplex in San Diego a few years ago. And knowing that in the future we could turn it, now there's seven bedrooms, but it's only one story. It's a block from the beach, and we could easily go an extra story. So that can add an additional quite a few bedrooms.
Wow, that's
Yeah.
extraordinary.
So yeah, that was a I 100% agree. The triplex, duplex, any plex, right? I didn't know that more than five was a commercial. So okay, interesting designation. Cool. Yeah, so what happened next? When did you realize like, all right, I have a lot of real estate, I'm pretty wealthy. And when did you kind of, 'cause now you own those properties in Vegas. Did you ever get into other sorts of real estate purchases aside, obviously the Vegas one isn't student housing.
Well, after 20 years, if there's one thing I can complain about with student rentals is that, you get older each year and they stay 19. It's always a new group of 19-year-olds. And so, after 20 years, it was a little bit of a wear on me. I also had a couple of properties that I had in partnership that I wanted to get out of partnerships. And I will recommend for your guys out there, if you can avoid partners, please, please try to do everything on your own if you can. If you need to get a smaller property on your own, do that, And I mean, even if you need to get, if you want to start out with my Roth IRA, I started out with a three-bedroom condo. So, I mean, we talked about duplexes and triplexes, and that's great. But if you're really starting from like scratch and you want to get into your first property, it's probably better to start with a condo, a student rental condo, versus a duplex or triplex in partnership with someone. So,
But wait, better if you have to partner to do the triplex, better to do the condo because it's better to
well,
not have partners,
better
or
to do
is
the
that?
condo by yourself that you own 100%,
Right.
Versus a duplex or triplex that you own in partnership.
Yeah.
It's even that much better to start with a duplex or a triplex, but I just kind of wanted to point that out as an example.
Partnerships can go bad very quickly with
and you can avoid my partnerships weren't that bad, but I just want complete control. I want to do the things the way that I want to do them. So I ended up selling about half of my student rentals and buying these hotel suites in Las Vegas. And now my portfolio, half of it is this these hotel suites in Vegas and half is student rentals in Boulder, Colorado. And it's a nice portfolio. I get a lot of positive feedback. When you own a hotel and people are on holiday, you get a lot of positive feedback. So that's a nice addition to the portfolio. And it doesn't quite do as well as the student rentals for income, but it's pretty close. It's mm-hmm. one of the few things that I found come close.
What would you recommend for someone who might have the money to, purchase a house, but they would want to live there? Would you recommend first going with an investment property and paying rent somewhere, or living where you, obviously in your situation, the triplex would be ideal.
Right. So that the smartest, and I ended up accidentally doing the smartest thing. If you're starting in real estate, the smartest way to start out is, and it's called an owner occupy when you live in your own unit, is you start out doing an owner occupied duplex or owner occupied triplex, and you live in one of the units. If you're in an owner occupied duplex or triplex, you get a lower interest rate on your loan because now you live there. You actually can put less down payment on the property as well. And then you can move out after a year or two and keep your really good loan that you got.
That's what we did for the place in San Diego I mentioned. That was a first time buyer too. So we ended up getting it, I think, 5% instead of the 20%. So,
wow.
Yeah.
See? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the best advice that I could give someone if they're starting out listening on this podcast is the best way to get on the rocket ride of real estate is to get into an owner occupied duplex or triplex.
Nice. Well, anything else that, you want to leave the listeners with?
Well, I just almost want to say I told you so, because a year ago we couldn't have done this podcast because everyone was so crypto crazy. And I love that real estate has stood the test of time. And I love that by and large, I've picked a really safe, secure, and an investment model that you can duplicate. They say that 70% of all self-made millionaires in the United States make it in real estate. So I've been to these financial seminars where people, these like tech entrepreneurs come up and they talk about their like cool little gadgety idea that they've got, and they got a piece of code that did this or whatever. And you can't duplicate that. So here's my boring business model that will make you a millionaire. Anybody can do it. And I wholeheartedly recommend it, especially in this post-crypto environment.
Yeah. Tell us the quote you posted in the group about turning making a small fortune.
Oh, crypto. Yeah. You can make a small fortune in crypto. You just have to start out with a large fortune.
I love that. Well, Ford, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And for you guys listening, I mean, this is the value of being in the group, is you got guys like Ford willing to help you. Dropping these knowledge bombs all the time, going over these strategies, and very eye-opening. You've obviously have told me about this before, but it was really fascinating to hear your story and the nitty-gritty. And you, I mean, it's so simple, right? It's just mm-hmm. There's nothing special about it. It's just a the data is there. It's just a proven, replicatable system if you just work it. So nothing flashy, but it works. And so thanks so much for sharing your wisdom and coming on. It's been super fun.
Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.